Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, February 5th, 2016, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group teleforum conference call on McDonnell v. United States. My name is Will Courtney, and I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Additionally, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today's program is going to be moderated by Will Hahn of Hunton and Williams, as well as the Federal Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group Executive Committee. So I'll turn things over to him now to introduce our panelists. Will, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you very much, Will. I'm looking forward to today's call. We have two great panelists with us to discuss what I think will be one of the most interesting cases of this court's term. On January 15th of this year, the Supreme Court granted certiorari in McDonald versus United States, and the court here will review the public corruption convictions of former Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell to determine whether the definition of official action as used in the federal bribery statute, Hobbs Act, and honest services statute is limited to exercising actual government power or the threat or pressure to do so. And if the definition is not so limited, the court will also consider whether the Hobbs Act and honest services statute are unconstitutional, given that such a broad definition could include political activity protected by the First Amendment. This is a call where we have two people who have been involved in commenting extensively on the case, and in the case of Brian Boone, authoring an amicus brief in the case. I should note at the outset that I have been involved in writing amicus briefs in this case, both at the Fourth Circuit and in the Supreme Court, and my comments today in no way are reflective of my role in that regard as representing our amici curiae clients or Hunton & Williams, my law firm. They are strictly my own comments in my role as moderator today. And with that disclosure out of the way, I am very pleased to introduce first Brian Boone from Alston & Byrd, who is going to be speaking in support of the governor's position in this case, and then also Professor Randall Eliason of GW University Law School, who will be setting forth his view of the case in support of the government. We're going to hear first from Brian for about 8 to 10 minutes, and then we'll turn the floor over to Randall for about 8 to 10 minutes to give his perspective. And then I will ask the panelists some questions, and after about 20 to 25 minutes of discussion in that regard, we'll turn the floor over to audience questions. And with that, I'm very pleased to turn the floor over to Brian for you to begin with your opening.
Thanks, Will, and thanks to the Federalist Society for hosting this call. As a bit of background, I'm a litigator at Alston & Byrd in the firm's Charlotte, North Carolina office. I and my colleagues Ted King and Emily McGowan are representing 60 former state attorneys general supporting Governor McDonnell at the Supreme Court. It's a bipartisan group. I think we're pretty well evenly split between Democrats and Republicans. And you see that even outside of our brief, there's strong bipartisan support for the governor. His supporters include leaders across the political spectrum. Now, I've seen some dismiss that as rent-seeking by the quote-unquote political class. I don't think that's right. I think that we're seeing such broad support because the case really does go to the heart of how we understand political life in America. Yeah, I'm sure that most folks on this call have at some point attended a political fundraiser or at least been invited to one. You give $500, you get to meet the candidate, maybe even have a conversation with them, that sort of thing. We don't think anything about those kinds of events. That kind of access to the political process is a routine part of American politics. Now, I used $500 as an example, but sometimes the price for that access is much higher than that. For instance, in 2011 or 2012, the New York Times reported that a group supporting President Obama's reelection coordinated it so that donors who gave or raised $500,000 got to attend quarterly meetings with the president at the White House. And I'm sure that those folks wanted to gain an audience with the president or perhaps with those around him. Unless we're willing to discard the First Amendment, that kind of access is illegal. As the Supreme Court made clear in Citizens United in McCutcheon, ingratiation and access are not corruption. They are protected First Amendment activities. So Congress may not punish them. It may punish only what we call quid pro quo corruption or its appearance. That means, and I'm quoting McCutcheon here, the direct exchange of an official act for money. So it's, I'll give you X, if you'll do Y, with the Y being official government action. Now, in one sense, everything that a president or a governor or a senator does could be described as official. So last night you may have heard that President Obama hosted the Golden State Warriors, who won the NBA championship last year. In the most general sense, we could say that that was an official meeting, but as the Supreme Court made clear in Sundiamond, that is not an official act within the meaning of the federal bribery statutes. Otherwise, President Obama could have committed a crime last night by accepting a Warriors jersey. Now, you may think that if you're a Wizards fan, but you would be wrong, in fact, under the law. With that background, I'll talk a little bit about the governor's trial. If you've read the press, you probably know about the gifts and the loans that the governor received from donor Johnny Williams, but you may not know that under Virginia law, a public official is not prohibited from accepting gifts from donors. There are some loose restrictions on receiving gifts, but they don't carry any criminal penalties. And I think it's important to emphasize here that there was no suggestion at the trial that Governor McDonnell violated Virginia law. Instead, the governor was charged with violating federal law, specifically the Hobbs Act and the Honest Services Fraud Statute. I'm not sure how much you know about those statutes, but they are as clear as mud and as broad as you can imagine. The Hobbs Act, which has been around for a long time, prohibits, and I'm quoting, extortion through the, quote, obtaining of property from another under color of official right. The Honest Services Fraud Statute, by contrast, has been around only about as long as Justin Bieber and, in my opinion, has caused about as much trouble. It prohibits a scheme or artifice to, quote, to deprive another of the intangible right of honest services. Now, you may be thinking, what the heck does that mean? Well, the Supreme Court used to share your sentiment. It's recognized that the statutes raise constitutional vagueness concerns. So through a couple of decisions, Skilling and Evans, the court has cabined them to reach only what we think of as classic bribery. You may have noticed that neither statute uses the term official act, but the definition of official act was at the center of the governor's trial. Where does that term come from? Well, in part, it comes from another federal statute, 18 U.S.C. Section 201, that prohibits a federal official from receiving anything of value in return for, quote, being influenced in the performance of an official act. That statute requires formal government action. So it's just, you know, think taking a bribe in exchange for awarding a public contract, that sort of thing. So why did that definition feature at the governor's trial, who is a state official? The answer in part lies in Skilling, where the court interpreted the Honest Services Fraud Statute by, quote, drawing content from other federal corruption statutes, including Section 201. You know, I would say that Skilling aside, if anti-corruption statutes can reach only quid pro quo arrangements, and that's what Citizens United and McCutcheon say, then it seems to me that the inquiry is always on some level going to focus on whether there was a payment made in exchange for an official act. As I noted, the governor's trial focused on his relationship with Johnny Williams, CEO of a Virginia-based company called Star Scientific. Williams made gifts and loans to the governor, likely hoping that state researchers would carry out clinical trials on a supplement that Williams wanted to bring to market. But the governor never put his thumb on the scale in Williams' favor. He never took or urged state action. The government nevertheless contended that Governor McDonnell violated federal law because he, one, asked and ate a question about research studies relating to Williams' company, two, appeared in public twice at receptions that Williams attended, and three, suggested and arranged a staff meeting with Williams. The governor argued that those acts don't qualify as official acts because he never took or pressured anyone else to take action on any government matter, and he requested jury instructions to that effect. The court, the district court, rejected his instructions, opting instead for a much broader definition of official act, and incredibly broad, in fact. The court told the jury that an official act, quote, may include acts that a public official customarily performs, which I would submit could perhaps include meeting with the Golden State Warriors, and that an official act, quote, is no less official because it is one in a series of steps to exercise influence or achieve an end. With that incredibly broad definition in hand, the jury convicted the governor, and you know the rest of the story. The Fourth Circuit affirmed, concluding that arranging meetings and attending events counts as official action. The Fourth Circuit also rejected the governor's reliance on Citizens United, basically saying that the case is irrelevant because it didn't involve the Hobbs Act or the Honest Services Fraud Statute. I find that aspect of the court's reasoning puzzling, frankly, and for a couple of reasons. For one, Citizens United involved federal statutes, and federal courts are charged with interpreting federal statutes consistently. So why wouldn't the appellate court look to Citizens United and McCutcheon to make sure that it was keeping things consistent? More importantly, the First Amendment is the First Amendment is the First Amendment. The First Amendment principles that animate Citizens United and McCutcheon apply equally to penal statutes like the Hobbs Act and the Honest Services Fraud Statute. It seems to me that those who advocate a kind of compartmentalized approach here really just want to limit Citizens United however they can. In the brief that we filed, we also described the serious federalism concerns raised by the governor's convictions. As I noted, no one argued at trial that the governor had violated Virginia law, and yet he now faces incarceration in the federal system because the courts below gave an incredibly broad reading to a vague definition of official act that applies on its face only to federal officials. Call me crazy, but I'm pretty sure that the founders would be surprised by that outcome. And in fact, they were not quick to displace state police power absent a clear directive from Congress. And I'll give you one example. From Federalist number 17, Alexander Hamilton said that there is one, quote, transcendent advantage belonging to the province of state governments. I mean the ordinary administration of criminal and civil justice. And just 2 years ago in Bond, the court reaffirmed that when a broad federal statute is ambiguous, courts should refer to basic principles of federalism to resolve that ambiguity. The Bond court also explained, I would note, that perhaps the clearest example of traditional state authority is the punishment of local criminal activity. And that, in fact, is the record of our country's history. Until the passage of the Hobbs Act in 1946, punishing state corruption was distinctly a state prerogative. In light of that fact, the court has said that if Congress wants to expand federal criminal jurisdiction at the expense of state criminal jurisdiction, it must not mince words. That principle, I think, was lost on both the district court and the Fourth Circuit. Instead of calibrating the definition of official act to preserve state responsibility in the area, they gave the term the broadest possible meaning and applied it to a state official in the broadest possible way, basically saying, Virginia law be damned. If the court sides with the governor, and I think that we should all hope that it does, I won't be surprised to see the court rely on federalism principles in its opinion. So what are the practical effects of the Fourth Circuit's decision? I think that they're serious. In our brief, we make the comment that in the wake of the decision, no lunch with a lobbyist is safe. I don't think that's an overstatement. The decision really does hand federal prosecutors virtually unfettered discretion to prosecute state officials for political courtesies and other acts that have gone on since the founding. It would also make state AG's job much more difficult. As my clients know well, public officials often look to the state attorney's general office for advice about thorny donor and campaign finance related questions. Now, too often, the answer, I'm afraid, will be, I really don't know, you got me. The Fourth Circuit's decision is not just bad for public officials, it's also bad for donors. The government can use the federal conspiracy statute to prosecute them, too. So what will the Supreme Court do? Again, we should all hope that the court reverses Governor McDonald's convictions. Otherwise, I think nearly every politician in the country is a criminal. And I guess that I would make one other point. Criminalizing conduct is not the only way to police public corruption. Voters can do so through the ballot box, and I think that gets lost sometimes in these discussions. With that, I will turn it back to you, William.
Thanks a lot, Brian. Professor Eliason, do you want to have your opening statement now?
Yes, thank you. Thanks to the Federalist Society for having me, and to Will and Brian. Folks should probably know, before I started teaching white-collar crime, I was a federal prosecutor, and I was the chief of the public corruption government fraud section at the U.S. Attorney's Office in D.C., so I do approach the case sort of from the background of a federal prosecutor of corruption cases. But since I'm teaching law school now, let's start with a hypothetical. So imagine that I go up to a politician and I say, I'm going to give you $100,000 in cash that you can just put in your pocket. It's going to be a secret gift. You don't have to report it anywhere. Don't have to disclose it on any kind of campaign finance forms. No one's going to know about it but you and me. And in exchange for that, I'd like you to introduce me to this person within the government who might be able to help me get this big government contract. And the politician says, okay, it's a deal. The logical implication of Governor McDonald's arguments and those who support him is that that's okay, that that's not corruption, because what the politician agreed to do does not fit some precise legalistic definition of a quote-unquote official act. I think most people think that's corruption. And in fact, my politician in my hypo could do that dozens of times, make himself a multimillionaire through these secret gifts with nobody ever finding out, by using the power of his office to get money and line his own pockets instead of acting in the public good. That's kind of the definition of corruption. In fact, let's take Brian's Golden State Warriors example with President Obama. Suppose the head of the Golden State Warriors had come up to the president and said, Mr. Obama, I'd like to give you $100,000 if you'll agree to host our team at the White House. And he says, sure. And that's a secret gift never disclosed to anybody. Do people not think that that would be a bribe? I think that's a bribe. That's a quid pro quo agreement to exercise your official power in exchange for a thing of value, a secret thing of value that's improper. So I think really the McDonald case is actually a relatively straightforward case of what we call quid pro quo corruption. And I agree with Brian on what that requires, what bribery requires, is a quid pro quo. In exchange for this thing of value, I will take certain, or I will agree to take certain, exercise my official power on your behalf. A bribe, the heart of a bribe is the agreement. It's the deal to sell the official office. It's not what is actually subsequently done by the public official and whether that action meets some particular precise definition of a quote-unquote official act. And what would the evidence in this case establish to the jury's satisfaction beyond a reasonable doubt and to every circuit judge on the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals to their satisfaction that Johnny Williams and Government McDonnell had an agreement, they had an understanding, but Johnny Williams would give him these secret gifts, undisclosed, not known to anybody else, in exchange for the governor's agreement that he and his wife would exercise the power of the governor's office on Williams' behalf to help him try to get his dietary supplement promoted within the government. That's the corrupt deal. Williams testified and testified, yes, that was our deal, that was our understanding. Now, of course, the governor testified and denied it, but then it's up to the jury to decide who they believe. And it was certainly more than reasonable for the jury to accept the government's argument that Bob McDonnell knew these gifts from Johnny Williams, a man he never knew before he ran for office. It's not like they're lifetime friends or anything. That Williams was showering him with these secret gifts, not out of admiration, you know, or friendship, but because he wanted something in return. And McDonnell agreed to provide that something. And that's all the law requires. So Brian and I actually agree on a couple other things. He suggested that the definition of official acts in the federal bribery statute may not really control in this case or may not really belong in this case. I think that's right. But I should point out that it was Governor McDonnell who insisted from day one, even before he was indicted, that he could only be prosecuted if the government could prove that whatever he did for Williams fit this precise definition of official act in a specific federal bribery statute that he wasn't even charged with. So I've said all along, I don't think that's right, and that the law of bribery is actually much broader than this one particular precise federal definition, which is actually only part of the federal bribery statute. Not every federal bribe, even under that statute, has to involve a quote-unquote official act. So I think the argument about whether what the governor did fits some precise definition of official act is largely a smokescreen, and it's been a pretty effective one, to allow the defense to take the focus off the corrupt nature of this deal and the secret gifts, the no paperwork, no interest, you know, quote-unquote loans, and the $10,000 shopping sprees and the Rolex watch and all the other things. Take the focus off that. And let's make a lawyerly argument about whether what McDonnell did fit this definition of action on a matter, case, controversy, matter coming before him in his official capacity. You know, let's make that kind of argument because we can't argue about these facts and this corrupt deal. So let's argue about whether it was an official act. I think that's been largely a diversion, but it's been a pretty successful one. And the reason that I think that's correct and that I think what he actually did and whether it fit that definition doesn't matter, is that it's 100% clear the law of bribery doesn't require that he did anything at all. All it requires is the deal, the agreement. Brian said at one point that the bribery law requires formal government action. It doesn't. All it requires is an agreement to exercise your official powers on behalf of the person that's paying you the bribe. So, for example, if I'm a politician and I take $100,000 from a building contractor in exchange for my agreement to steer a contract to him to renovate some large public building, and then the next day that building burns down before I had a chance to do anything, that's not a defense. The fact that I never end up doing anything is not a defense. But bribery has been committed by the corrupt deal where I agreed to sell the power of my office, and that's exactly what happened in this case. But beyond that, McDonnell actually did do some things. And the things that he did included not only introducing Williams to others in the government, but holding a product launch event at the governor's mansion to try and promote the product. And the fact that he didn't succeed, the evidence at trial suggested, was largely because the governor's staff kind of resisted. They didn't like Williams. They didn't think the product was very impressive. And so, you know, the governor's staff had the good sense to resist his efforts to try to get them to promote Williams' product. And that turned out to be a good thing for the governor, because now it allows him to come back and argue, well, Williams never really got anything. But the fact that his staff had the good sense to resist him isn't a defense if the corrupt deal existed that he was going to exercise his power. A third point is this question of whether this was legal under state law. And this has been raised a lot, again, by McDonnell and his supporters, that what the governor did was legal under Virginia state law. It wasn't. Virginia state law did allow politicians to accept undisclosed gifts. That's true. But it doesn't allow them to accept those gifts in exchange for a quid pro quo deal to take some specific government action. That's corruption. That's bribery that's prohibited by every state. So it's the distinction between just accepting the gifts and accepting them in exchange for a deal to use your power to benefit the gift giver in return, and the latter is what the government found here. Virginia law defines bribery as taking something of value in exchange for being influenced in a decision, opinion, recommendation, vote, or other exercise of discretion as a public servant. There's no, you know, requirement of a quote-unquote official act, exercise of discretion. But the point is, it's not accurate to say this didn't violate Virginia law. It did. Virginia law wasn't a part of the case, and that's understandable because it was a federal case. But the fact that Virginia law wasn't part of the case is not the same thing as saying there was some kind of finding or ruling that a quid pro quo corruption deal would not violate Virginia law, because based on what the jury found, McDonald's conduct clearly did violate state law. And then the final point I'll make is that I think the claims of McDonald's supporters are greatly overstated. The idea that no lunch with a lobbyist now is safe, or that you can't attend a political fundraiser, are largely, you know, politicians claiming that the sky is falling. I think McDonald was convicted about a year and a half ago. I don't think we've seen any signs that government has ground to a halt in the interim. And the fact is that there's a huge difference between routine political support, attending a fundraiser, providing campaign donations, donations to PACs, things that are open, above board, disclosable, and part of our system, and the kind of secret, corrupt, under-the-table gifts that were going on in this case. And if you hold a fundraiser and you go and listen to your constituents and consider their views and even later on take action that they favor, that's not the same thing as entering into a corrupt deal with them that if they give you these gifts, particular gifts, or even a particular campaign contribution, you're going to agree to take a specific official action in exchange. That's quid pro quo corruption. And sometimes that line is fine between the two, and that's kind of the nature of white-collar crime, and it's the nature of political corruption when, as long as we have a system of privately financed campaigns where politicians have a need to raise money, there are going to be cases that are close calls or that seem to fall close to the line. But I don't think the McDonald case is one of them. I think it's a relatively straightforward case of political corruption and that the Supreme Court should affirm. That's all.
Well, thank you very much for that. I'm going to turn now to some questions that I think will play off of both of your opening statements in the course of answering them, feel free, of course, to respond to one another's openings as appropriate. And so in that respect, I'd like to start first with a question for Brian. I think one interesting aspect of the governor's appeal, and I think you hear it a little bit in what Randall's been saying, is that there's some people draw a distinction between corruption cases that occur outside the campaign electoral context and then the cases that occur within the campaign contribution context, cases like Citizens United, McCutcheon, things like that. Now, many of the arguments that are used by those supporting the governor rely heavily, as you pointed out, Brian, on cases like Citizens United and McCutcheon, and take the position that this is just one sort of seamless garment, if you will. If you look at Sundiamond and you compare its emphasis on the link to a particular official act and the discussion in Citizens United and McCutcheon about proving quid pro quo, both a quid and a quo, that this is all seamless. However, I think there are other people, and you hear it in Randall's comments, that suggest that no, there really are just different contexts, and that makes sense because when we're talking about campaign contributions, we're just talking about something that's obviously different for First Amendment purposes than the types of gifts and other influence that was being sought here. And I think this is something that the D.C. Circuit made a point of saying in United States versus Ring, where it contrasted for First Amendment purposes campaign contributions and then gifts. And so I'm just wondering, you know, what's the argument for seeing these lines of cases, the corruption cases versus the campaign contributions, as consistent with one another, or and responding to what Randall and others are saying, that really we're talking about different contexts?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. And I guess I would ask Randall what he thinks about Citizens United, because I think, I mean, although it's not an exact science, I think you can probably tell what how folks might shake out on this question depending on how they think about Citizens United. If you think about it as an important First Amendment decision, then you're likely to want to import it to every area that you can. If you don't, then you're going to want to confine it as much as you can. I mean, I would say that, you know, on this, you know, notion that there are campaign finance cases and there are corruption cases and there the twain shall meet, I don't think that that's how the court likely is going to approach things going forward, especially given what the court has said in Citizens United and McCutcheon. I mean, McCutcheon says that a quid pro quo requires the direct exchange of an official act for money. I don't see how the court is going to ignore that statement in corruption cases, and I don't think that it should. And it also gets to this notion that we can draw tight lines around when an election, qua election, ends and governance begins. Those are difficult lines to draw, and I think that in drawing those lines, the tie should go to robust First Amendment protections for ingratiation and access, which is not corruption. I guess I would also want to briefly respond to Professor Eliason's point that, I guess his thinking that the definition of official act from Section 201 shouldn't have been imported, or perhaps shouldn't have been imported at the governor's trial. I would say take that up with the Supreme Court, because in Skilling, the court drew content from the other federal corruption statutes, including Section 201, in interpreting the honest services fraud statute. And to the notion that Governor McDonald didn't need to complete any official act, of course he didn't need to complete any official act through its end, but he had to agree to perform acts that would qualify as official acts. And the definition of official act from Section 201 is instructive in that way, and it says that an official act is any decision or action on any question, matter, cause, suit, proceeding, or controversy. Those terms taken together bespeak a certain level of formality, the wielding of formal government power on an actual government decision, and that didn't happen here. Now, for all the gifts that Johnny Williams gave the governor never put his thumb on the scale in Williams's favor. There was never any recommendation at any of these meetings. He asked questions, but of course the governor is free to ask questions about a product that he thinks might be helpful to residents in his state. That's not the same thing as exchanging an official act for those gifts.
Professor Eliason, do you have any comments before ask you a question? Yeah,
sure. This is Randall again. A couple things. In terms of Citizens United, I mean, I guess I think it's largely irrelevant. It's not a criminal case. It's not a case interpreting the federal criminal statutes. And I think the governor and his supporters have read way too much into this kind of passing dicta in Citizens United about how ingratiation and access are not corruption. But even putting that aside, I agree with Brian. What corruption requires is a quid pro quo deal. That's what Citizens United said, and that's what we have here in this case, in my opinion. The First Amendment, I don't think anybody would argue the First Amendment protects the right of Johnny Williams to take Maureen McDonnell on a $10,000 shopping spree in New York to buy inaugural gowns for her without disclosing that to the public, or to pay for the caterer for Bob McDonnell's wedding, or to give him a Rolex watch. I mean, the what's going on here with the governor and his supporters is this great blurring of the enormous distinctions in this case between routine political support in terms of campaign finance contributions and the like, and the kind of corrupt secret gifts that Williams was giving. They're not the same thing at all. And that gets blurred a lot by the suggestion that, you know, this case has grave implications for our entire political system. It doesn't, as long as you're not making corrupt secret deals in exchange for these kinds of inappropriate gifts. The question of official act, I mean, you know, that's a little down in the weeds, I think, in terms of interpreting the statutes, but I'll just say Skilling made this reference to it draws content from the definition of official act. That's fine, but that can't be the full definition, because honest services fraud applies to state and local officials. 201 doesn't. Honest services fraud applies to private individuals, employer-employee relationship. No bribery statute applies to them. So clearly honest services fraud is not limited by the definition contained in one particular federal statute. And as I pointed out, you know, the Virginia bribery statute is actually much broader. Since we're talking about a Virginia governor, maybe for purposes of honest services fraud, it should draw content from the Virginia bribery statute, which talks about exercising your discretion in exchange for a thing of value. But again, we have to draw the distinction between what was actually done, which doesn't really matter legally, and what was agreed to. And what was agreed to, the jury found, was that the governor was going to exercise the powers of his office to try to help Williams. That's the corrupt deal. Whether he was ultimately successful, either because his staff resisted or because he changed his mind or never got around to it or whatever, that doesn't matter. The corrupt deal is taking that $170,000 in gifts in exchange for the agreement that I'm going to use the power of my office to help you out. And so I think that's the key question, again, that's getting kind of glossed over.
So, Randall, picking up on your comments, I'm going to ask you, really, I think it's maybe two questions in one, but you're talking about them both, so I'll have a question that kind of goes to both. The first is this issue about why concerns about this case showing a criminalization of politics is just being overblown because the gifts at issue are just completely different from campaign contributions, and that the emphasis should be upon the influence as opposed to the precise nature of the action, and that explains in part why you can't really understand official action as it's defined in the federal bribery statute, but rather when Skilling narrows honest services to core bribery, it's really talking about more like a common law type bribery or maybe a model penal code type bribery. But I guess my question with respect to that is twofold. One, is that really putting the emphasis back on the nature of the quid when the concern is the quo and the nature of the quo? And as we know, bribery cases can be based on campaign contributions. So how do you ensure by emphasizing the quid to that extent that you're not criminalizing political activity when no specific official act connected to the exercise of government power has to be identified? I mean, I think if you look at Skilling and its emphasis on core bribery and paradigmatic kickbacks, a rejection that it's creating a common law crime in its narrowing construction, and the overall concerns about vagueness, I mean, I would think that points to understanding official action as it's understood in statute, and that these cases actually have to care and focus on what the quo is. I mean, is that wrong?
I mean, I guess, you know, law professors like to respond to questions with questions. I'll answer your question, but my first response would be another question back to Brian. I guess the hypothetical I began my opening statement with, do you think that's okay? Do you think that's not bribery? If I give a politician $100,000 in secret money to introduce me to someone in the government who might be able to get me a contract, like I said, I think that's corruption. And to answer your more general question, Will, I would say all quids are not created equal, and that's what the governor and his supporters are trying to suggest. Yes, a bribery case can be based on a campaign contribution, but it would be much rarer, and you'd require a whole different level, a whole different quantum of proof to establish that in exchange for that exact contribution, there was a specific agreement to exercise some specific power in return, and that it's not just the general support of your constituents or actions that favor your supporters that politicians have all the time. So you always have to look at both sides of the corrupt deal. And my argument is that when the quid is so much more clearly corrupt, then you've got a whole different type of case and the sort of whiff of corruption about the interaction there than you do with any case involving routine political supporters, donors, fundraisers, campaign contributions. A case based on that would face a much higher hurdle in terms of proof to establish that what was going on was actually a corrupt deal. There's no question that in, like I said, in a system of privately financed campaigns, there are gray areas here, and there are going to be close calls, and we can all come up with hypotheticals that suggest, you know, results we might not like. But that's kind of the nature of this type of criminal case. And when it comes to the McDonald case, though, I don't think this is a particularly strong example of why we should be concerned. I think it's a relatively straightforward corruption case.
And Brian, sort of building on that, I'm going to ask you a question related to those comments, and then the sort of general, I think, policy question that comes from what Randall's saying as well. First is that, you know, in fairness to Randall, I mean, there are a number of lower courts that have just frankly not been receptive to arguments that Skilling's limitation of honest services to core bribery and kickbacks undermines a sort of stream of benefits view of honest services prosecutions, meaning that there's a whole lot of quid. I mean, we don't necessarily point to a quo, but there's so much quid over such a long period of time that there must have been an agreement. And as we saw in the Fourth Circuit's opinion, I mean, there is a disagreement among the lower courts about whether Sundiamond's discussion of a specific link between a thing of value and official act should be considered persuasive. And some courts do reason that Sundiamond wasn't a bribery case, it's a gratuities case, that its analysis is dicta, and that the quid pro quo is satisfied simply because the quo is subsumed within the agreement. So, I mean, there are a lot of cases that sort of take that position. And what I guess my question for you is your response to the fact that there are a number of cases like that in the lower courts, and then the sort of broader policy point that Randall's comments, I think, are suggesting, which is that the American people may draw a distinction between how political we expect elected officials to be in a campaign context versus in a context where we're expecting a fair administration of the laws. And so maybe it makes sense to have a slightly looser understanding of corruption in the context where we have a higher expectation of less political activity. I mean, so how do you sort of respond to those concerns?
Sure, and Professor Eliason, I'll respond to you as perhaps a French law student might in one of your classes with answering your hypothetical with a hypothetical. Taking my example of the $500,000 donors who were meeting with President Obama quarterly at the White House, let's assume that some of those people are meeting with him because they want to gain an audience with him or those around him, and they have a product that they want to sell and they think it will be beneficial to the country. And they're hoping that at that meeting they'll meet somebody in the government who might be able to help along their product. Would you consider that bribery? And I don't, because the president is not, even if he introduces the donor to one of his brethren, political brethren around him, and says, hey, you should meet this guy, he's a good guy, he is not taking official action. And I think that the Supreme Court, through Citizens United, through McCutcheon, is drawing the line and saying, when First Amendment values are at stake, we are going to be very careful. We're going to assiduously draw this line so that we're not going to limit the flow of money into politics just for the sake of limiting money flowing into politics. It has to be actually corrupt. There has to be a quid pro quo, an exchange of a payment for a definite official act. And I don't think that in the Obama example or the McDonald example that you gave, that there is an official act. And certainly in the facts in Governor McDonald's case, there was no official act. Nothing ever came of Johnny Williams's access. Today he's probably frustrated that nothing ever came of that access. And that's because the governor never picked up the gavel and said, this is going to happen. And I think it's important that we keep that in mind in engaging quid pro quo arrangements. And earlier, Professor Eliason said that he agreed with me that that there has to be a quid pro quo. But then in the way that he described what a quid pro quo was, you can see sort of the slipperiness of his argument, because he said that he believes that Governor McDonald made an agreement with Johnny Williams to help him out. Well, if I make a $500 donation to a political candidate and I go to a fundraiser and the candidate introduces me to somebody in the community and that turns out to benefit me, whether politically or economically or some other way, that is helping me out. But that is not exchanging payment for an official act. And that is what the law requires. And I think the law does, require that now. And so, Will, to your question about cases in the lower courts not fully buying into Skilling, and it sure seems like Professor Eliason would reject Skilling just as an initial matter. I think that we will see over time at Citizens United and McCutcheon, and the reasoning underlying those decisions works itself out, that courts will be more likely to, and maybe even forced to, accept Skilling's rationale that we're really talking about classic bribery here and nothing else.
Well, thank you. And so we have time for audience questions. I'm just going to ask one broader policy-related question left to Randall, and feel free to both weigh in on this. Though I think, Brian, this is something you had mentioned a bit in your opening about how we have more than one vehicle for going after relationships and corruption in politics, or real or perceived, and that is the democratic process. And so the question I sort of have is, I think if you look at Federalist 10 and Federalist 51, where Madison's talking about the problem of factions, I mean, we knew from the outset of the country that there would be people who would try to use politics for their own good as opposed to the public good. They would be self-interested. They would try to play factions off against each other. But the solution in the Federalist Papers wasn't to criminalize all of this behavior. It was to let, as Madison says in 51, ambition counter ambition, to have campaigns that reward the opponent of the candidate or the official who has the relationship that you think is troubling, to criticize them, to not act on their agenda, to let the voters decide, to vote them out of office. And I'm just wondering why those aren't sufficient remedies that, I mean, they clearly would obviate any First Amendment concern that exists, and it allows the voters themselves to decide whether these types of relationships, which we've all agreed can come in very close cases, really do warrant condemnation. Why isn't that a sufficient remedy? Why is federal prison the needed remedy?
Yeah, I'll actually agree with your premise, which I'm always telling my students, look, there's a lot of sleazy, rotten stuff that goes on in the world that isn't criminal and doesn't have to be. And when you're talking about politicians, there is always the remedy of the ballot box as an option. When it comes to corruption cases, though, the trouble with that argument is that it assumes a fully informed electorate. And when you're talking about corruption and secret gifts that take place under the table, like those in the McDonald case, The public doesn't know about those. That's the whole point. Neither McDonnell nor Williams wants the public to know. And so how can they possibly make a judgment at the ballot box on a politician's behavior when they never know about it? So that's kind of the nature of political corruption. And when we're talking about campaign contributions, at least there's sunlight to act as the disinfectant, right? When they're disclosed, at least people know who's supporting where the politician's money is coming from, and that can become an issue in the campaign, as we see now, for example, all the time, right? Hillary Clinton is criticized for taking money from Wall Street. I mean, that's publicly out there, and the voters can make a judgment about it. But when we're talking about corruption, they don't have that information, so I don't think that argument is particularly valid in all cases.
And this is Brian. So I agree that political accountability is a sufficient answer. And I would also note, backing up, I mean, look, you know, there's a proverb that says that what's done in the dark is shouted from the rooftops eventually. And I buy that notion. But I would also say that just because you pass a criminal statute doesn't mean that you are putting politics to the side. And in fact, if a statute is broadly drawn and is ambiguous, you really are opening up the criminal system to the politicization of corruption prosecutions. And you know, a lot of times, if you with a statute in hand like the Honest Services Fraud Statute or the Hobbs Act, prosecutors' charging decisions can reflect more personal predilection than legal interpretation.
Well, thank you both, and I think it makes sense at this point, Will, to turn over to audience questions.
All right. In a moment, we'll all hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to ask your question, enter star, then the pound key. Okay, again, if you want to ask a question, just hit star and the pound key, and we will answer questions in the order they're received. Will, I don't see anyone jumping on with a question immediately, but I will let you know as soon as we have one if you want to continue the discussion.
Okay, I think that's fine. I guess I'll just sort of pick up where we were continuing on about this issue of whether the corruption was in fact occurring in private. It seems to me that, and I'm certainly no political prognosticator, but it seems to me that Ken Cuccinelli lost the governor's race for a number of reasons, but it seemed like one of the reasons that was discussed often was Governor McDonnell's relationships. And so I'm just wondering, again, if this isn't a manifestation of a better remedy that doesn't implicate all these First Amendment concerns, which we all sort of agree can exist in an area that's so filled with close cases and vagueness.
Well, can I jump in? This is Randall.
Sure.
I just want to sort of object to the continued reference to First Amendment concerns, I guess, because I don't think there's a legitimate First Amendment concern in Johnny Williams, you know, buying Maureen McDonald's ball gowns or paying for the governor's daughter's wedding caterer or $120,000 in undocumented loans. I mean, we're not talking about McCutcheon. We're talking about a criminal corruption scheme, and the constant reference to First Amendment concerns in this case, I think it's just misguided. In a different case, if you were prosecuting someone for campaign contributions, then you could talk about that, but I just don't think that's what we've got here. The facts are not irrelevant.
This is Brian, and I agree that the facts are not irrelevant. It just so happens that the facts show that the governor never put his thumb on the scale in Johnny Williams' favor, and that matters.
No, it doesn't, actually, as long as he agreed to.
Gets to a question that I had, because I know, Professor Eliason, you've written a lot and certainly during this call have said a lot about what you actually, if you actually have to prove official action at all, what you have to show sort of beside the point. And I'm wondering, because that's, as I recall, that's a position that the government abandoned fairly early on in the litigation. And so I'm just wondering why you think that the government abandoned it and that it wasn't really raised at the district court level or the court of appeals or sort of beyond that.
Well, I'm not sure I would agree that they abandoned it, and I don't have any inside information on you know, their strategies. But I think it's always a part of the law of bribery. It's just a fact that the crime is the agreement, not what's subsequently done. And so both sides have been talking about this definition of official act a lot throughout the entire case, and I don't know the reasons for that. But if we step back and just think about the law of bribery in general, it's completely clear that you don't have to actually show the public official did anything. And so as long as the jury believed Williams when he said to the governor, I had an agreement that in exchange for these gifts, he would use the power of his office to try to help promote an anti-block, that's sufficient. And then the evidence that came out of trial of what the governor actually did do to try at least to take some steps that, in that direction, introducing him to other officials and holding the product launch event, things like that, that's simply evidence that the corrupt agreement existed. But those particular actions by the governor don't have to fit some precise legalistic definition of an official act to prove the crime of bribery.
This is Brian. I would hope that when we're talking about ingratiation and access, that a prosecution would have to fit the tight definition in a statute instead of being left to prosecutors sort of generalized understanding, maybe even drawing on public perception about what's corrupt and what's not corrupt. And that's the point that the Supreme Court was making, I think, in Citizens United and McCutcheon. In McCutcheon, the court says that ingratiation and access embody a central feature of democracy, that constituents support candidates who share their beliefs and interests, and candidates who are elected can be expected to be responsive to those concerns.
This is Randall. I just don't think that's threatened at all by the McDonald case, because that kind of political support and political acts that are taken in response is not quid pro quo corruption.
This is Will Courtney at the Federalist Society. We do have a question on the line now, so I'm going to go ahead to that first caller.
Hi, this is John Shortino from Maryland, and I very much enjoyed the conversation so much, and it does seem like it leads to lots of important issues on both sides. But my question is for Professor Eliason, whom I believe said that sometimes campaign contributions could be the basis for a bribery prosecution. And I just wanted to ask, under what circumstances would that be fitting, and would there be very difficult line-drawing problems?
Yes, there would be. It's very, a case like that is extremely rare, but one of the governor's primary points when he's trying to argue that, this case has grave implications for our political system is that indeed it's theoretically possible for a campaign contribution to be a bribe. But what you would have to show is a very clear quid pro quo agreement where I go into the politician and say, I'm going to donate $10,000 to your campaign. In exchange, will you introduce this legislation for me? And the politician says, yes, I will. I mean, almost that kind of a clear deal. If you have that, that's still bribery, but that's not new. I mean, that's always been the law. It's not something created by the McDonald case. But my point was just, if you're talking about a campaign contribution that's within our legal campaign system that we have, then the hurdle is going to be a lot higher to try to show there was a corrupt deal going on versus just politics as usual, the politicians doing what they always do, raising money and acting on behalf of their constituents without a corrupt deal. But if you're talking about these kinds of gifts, under the table, secret gifts, clearly improper in anyone's mind, then the whiff or presumption of corruption is a lot stronger. So you always have to look at the entire relationship and the entire deal, and not all quids are created equal.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we do have time to answer another question, I think. We don't have any on the line. If you'd like to ask a final question, please hit star and the pound key. And we do have one more question, so we'll go to that call now.
David Emerson, society member in Berkeley, California. I'd like to get some reaction to the ability to distinguish between cases where there's a private individual seeking benefit versus the usual political process that goes along between politicians where you support my bill, I'll support your bill, or you vote for my, you know, judicial candidate for a nomination to the Supreme Court, and I'll give you some kind of other benefit. And do you view that these cases are of a similar nature, or that they can be readily distinguished?
That's a great question. This is Randall. I don't think they are the same. That's a good example of the Seventh Circuit just recently in the Governor Blagojevich appeal talked about sort of political log rolling, you know, political favor trading that goes on all the time, and throwing out some of his convictions, although not all, you know, made the point that that kind of political deal making has never been thought to be corrupt, at least in the legal sense of our corruption laws. And so there is a distinction between the sort of business of politics, which requires that kind of deal-making to some extent, and situations where you've got outside, you know, undisclosed corrupt gifts, things of value being given to politicians to try to influence them. So the law does draw that distinction, although you're certainly right that to some extent there are kind of similarities in terms of the underlying concerns.
Okay, I think that's all the time we have for questions. Will, do you want to bring us home here?
Sure. I would just like to say thank you both to Brian and to Randall for participating in what I think has been a very fascinating and interesting discussion, and hopefully illuminating to the people on the call. And I think it touches on a lot of different values that tend to be associated with members of the Federalist Society. So I think it's been illuminating for all of us, and I just wanted to thank you both for your time and participation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you, all three of you, and thank you to our audience for dialing in today. Until our next call, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.